I was to say, PhD student at the University of Toronto, working with Dick Bond and Renee Hosek. And he's been doing a lot of interesting work on constraining particle physics using cosmological observables. So he's going to talk about probing the string axioverse of galaxy surveys today. Take it away.
Thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure being at PI. The subject that I want to discuss today is the intersection of cosmology and particle physics, so I hope it will appeal to many of you in the audience and online. So as with many cosmology talks, our starting point will be the Lambda CDM model of the universe. The Lambda CDM model is very successful at predicting the large-scale structure that we observe throughout the evolution of the cosmos. It says that around 95% of the energy density the universe is in this dark sector made of dark energy and dark matter, and it is of the latter that I want to focus today. So dark matter is often described as cold, that is, it is collisionless, pressureless, it interacts very light, almost doesn't interact with light, as far as we know, and it's defined by its absence of properties, making it very difficult to pinpoint its origin in particle physics. But as successful as the Lambda CDM model has been, recent observations have shown certain tensions between different experiments. So I'm sure you've seen those plenty of time. The one on the left is the Hubble tension, which is a discrepancy in the measurement of the expansion rate of the universe from the early universe measurements from the CMB to late measurements from the cosmological distance ladder. The other one is the sigma 8 tension. So sigma 8 is a derived parameter, which measures the variance of the density fluctuations on scales of 8 megaparsec. It is very degenerate with the total matter content of the universe. Sometimes it's expressed as S8 rather than sigma 8, which is a product of sigma 8 and some contribution of omega matter. But the tension is similarly to the Hubble tension between early measurements and late time measurements. There are also some small scale tensions with cold dark matter specifically. Now, these tensions are not of the same kind as the ones I just showed. These don't arise between experiments, but rather between simulations and observations. The first one is the missing satellites problem, which is the fact that in simulations of cold dark matter, we expect to see a lot of substructure in a halo of the Milky Way size. However, given the number of satellite galaxies that we observe, it seems like a lot of these satellite halos are missing. The one at the center is the Costa core problem. That is the fact that in cold dark matter simulations, again, we expect to see a cuspy density profile, that is a density profile which diverges at towards the center of the halo. But what we observe in certain galaxies is that, in fact, the density profile seems to level off towards the center, which is a cored rather than a cuspy profile. And finally, there's the diversity in the rotation curves of dwarf galaxies. Given the universality of the density profile coming from cold dark matter, the NFW profile, we'd expect to see very standard and uniform rotation curves for many galaxies with halos of similar masses. But what we observe is a wide range of rotation curves. I have to say that baryonic physics and physics model have been shown to alleviate some of these tensions. These came from originally cold dark matter only simulations, so adding baryonic physics can help alleviate some of these. Also, self-interacting dark matter has been suggested as one of the potential solutions for the diversity of rotation curves. And so these tensions are a good starting point to look for different properties of dark matter, which we can help uncover its origin in particle physics. And one such candidate is the ultralight axion, or fuzzy dark matter, as it's sometimes known. So this concept has been studied heavily in the literature under very different names, but the concept is essentially the same. It's the idea that dark matter is composed of a very light particle of mass around 10 to the negative 21 eV. At that mass, the de Broglie wavelength of the particle becomes astrophysical, and the particle behaves more as a wave than a particle, as evidenced by many simulations by different groups. And then it exhibits a wide range of features, including interference patterns in filaments and structure, substructure being erased on small scales, as the fuzzy dark matter or the wave dark matter is more diffuse than cold dark matter, so it doesn't cluster quite as much. And also at the center of halos, we see these solitonic cores, which are these almost constant density balls you can see in the simulation in the center, which are these spherical entities of almost constant density. And then on the outskirts, the halos exhibit, again, the NFW profile. And so for these reasons, fuzzy dark matter was initially thought as a great solution to some of the problems that I outlined earlier. Now, one of the issues with having a boson of mass 10 to the negative 22 eV composing all of the dark matter is that it is, in fact, too effective at erasing structure on small scales, and it is disfavored by many different observables, which are complementary to each other with different sets of test systematics. And so it's says to be essentially ruled out astronomically. Nevertheless, the idea of a dark matter wave function when I started graduate school was very interesting to me. And one of the things that I was hoping to find was a particle physics origin for a particle like this. So if we assume that dark matter is ultralight, where can it arise in particle physics? And the first candidate that comes to mind is the QCD axion. So the QCD axion is a light boson. It was introduced in quantum chromodynamics to solve the strong CP problem. It is said to clean the Lagrangian of QCD, which is why it's named after detergent. It was shown to be able to account for the dark matter in the universe, I think as early as 1983 by three different groups. But a lot of the cosmological studies on axions suggest a mass above the micro EV scale. And even at 10 to the negative 10, I think there are some strong bounds coming from black hole super radiance, for example. And so although the axion is very, very light compared to other dark matter candidates, it doesn't quite satisfy the properties that we're looking for. Thankfully, axions also arise in other high energy extensions of the standard model, including string theory. String theory allows for these ultralight axions and is very good at producing them. In fact, it might be a bit too good at producing them. The axion in this context doesn't come alone. It comes with 10 or 100 sister particles, which are other axions of different masses. And this whole set of axions is referred to as an axiverse. So even though the mass distribution of these axions is not exactly known, we know that the axions most likely fall within a spectrum with logarithmically distributed masses. That is, they populate each decade of mass all the way down to possibly 10 to the negative 33 eV, which is the Hubble scale today. Now, in this picture, each axion would contribute only a small amount to the total dark matter budget of the universe. And so each of the relic densities of these axions would be much smaller than the total dark matter content. Now, this is a great way to build a model with an ultralight particle from particle physics. However, having all of these free parameters in a cosmological model simply wouldn't work. And so we have to simplify this picture a little bit. And that is to realize that a lot of these heavier axions would have a de Broglie wavelength, which is non-astrophysical. It would be very, very, very small compared to the scales that we can resolve. And so they would behave essentially like cold dark matter. And so if we group all of these axions as a cold dark matter density, we simply clump them together. We can also assume for simplicity that there is a single axion which lies in the ultralight regime, that is to the left of the 10 to the negative 21 eV line. Then in that case, we get a model which is very similar to cold dark matter, but with one supplementary ingredient. And in that case, we really have two free parameters. The first is the mass of this ultralight axion, so where it lies in the spectrum in this gray area, and the axion, what we call the axion fraction, which is the total amount of axions over the total dark matter content in the universe. So that fraction is very helpful. In the case where F is equal to 1, we recover the fuzzy dark matter models that I showed earlier, which is very well studied. And in the case where F equals 0, we recover lambda CDM, which is, again, a very well studied. So we have these two limiting cases, which are very well known. Now, this model initially was motivated by particle physics, but we've seen recently that the introduction of a small amount of these ultralight particles can help solve alleviate some of the tensions that we have with lambda CDM. And one of these examples, those are all very recent papers, so these are very recent developments. But the idea is that having a small amount of these ultralight particles will change the total amount of clustering in the universe and change for example, the value of sigma 8. In the case of Hubble, what the Blum and Theodori team did is that they looked at the effect of having these ultralight particles at the center of halos. And since they changed the density profile of halos, they changed the amount of lensing that we observe, and then can alter the measurement of the H naught value coming from lensing. Now, a lot of these partially ultralight dark matters are also combined with some other ingredient, for example, early dark energy or decaying dark energy. This is due to the fact that solving the Hubble tension by changing the early universe physics sometimes worsens the sigma 8 tension. And so the axions are then added to the model to dampen out the matter power spectrum and make it possible to solve both the H naught and S8 tension simultaneously. Now, you might worry that we start adding a bit too many free parameters to our models. But the main motivation for this slide is that the common denominator here seems to be this small amount of very, very light dark matter.
The percentage is energy density contribution to dark matter.
Exactly. So it's this fraction here. It's the, the axions over the total dark matter.
In this Blum paper, you're saying he's only trying to explain the whole
No, it only comes really from lensing, yeah.
Which is like the least legal model out of all of the measurements. Okay.
Yeah. This is why other dark energy type scalar fields, like early dark energy, which is a dark energy with a periodic potential, very similar to ultralight axions, is also added on top of the axion. Because in this case, it would change the H naught value measured from CMB rather than late time measurements.
Yeah, the two tooth fairy is probably a bit more than what
those do. Absolutely. Which is why for the remainder of the talk, I will focus only on the ultralight dark matter part and not worry too much about the Hubble side of things. But it's just interesting to see how the ultralight dark matter seems to come up in so many of these models. So again, as I've mentioned, we've now have lambda CDM plus those two free parameters, which are the axion mass and the axion fraction. And the way to constrain these is to make use of all of the data that we have available today. So being an early career researcher in cosmology, today is a very exciting time because of the wealth of data that we have and are still collecting. And of the many, many telescopes that we can use, the two that I'm going to focus on today are more with a large scale structure and galaxy surveys, which is the BOS data and the dark energy survey. So this is here an overview of the axion parameter space.
Sorry, can I ask a question? Is there a coherent background for this axion field, or like, because if the mass is very small, it would be like dark energy. But do you have that or not?
So the dark energy axion would lie right over here in our spectrum. Absolutely. Not in our studies, but it's interesting to think about axions being lighter than 10 to the negative 33 eV, because then it could account for both dark matter and dark energy within that whole spectrum. But yes, yeah. And in the early universe, a lot of these very light fields would behave as dark energy. So in order to behave like dark matter through matter radiation equality up to today, it would have to be heavier than 10 to the negative 28 eV. So these constraints outline the axion mass and axion fraction parameter space. The filled-in regions are the present constraints, while the lines here are forecasted constraints. And what we can see is that there are sort of two regimes that we work with. The first one is the very light axions, which are very, very well constrained to very low fractions, about 1% of the total dark matter content of the universe. And there is also the heavier axions at 10 to the negative 24 eV and above, which are only constrained for very large fractions. So that is to say, they're only constrained in the regime where they're essentially like fuzzy dark matter, where they compose all of the dark matter in the universe. And we'll see later why that is. So if we want to constrain dark matter particles with large-scale structure, our starting point will be the matter power spectrum. In this case, this is a linear matter power spectrum for cold dark matter with, as a reminder, the large scales are at low k and the small scales are at high k. And the power spectrum is just a measurement of the variance of the density perturbations at different scales. It is the Fourier transform of the correlation function. So the way to understand the growth of perturbations with axions is to compare it with cold dark matter. So in the case of cold dark matter, you have a pressureless fluid, but when you introduce axions, the mass, there is a mass-dependent term which enters the equation. And this mass dependence is dominant at very low k. So it is a very strong scale dependence, a k to the fourth, and also a mass dependent relative to h bar. So this is where our measurement of or concept of ultralight dark matter comes from. It's relative to the reduced Planck constant. So we can see two limiting cases. The first one is as m tends to infinity, we recover cold dark matter. The same thing happens when k goes to zero. So on very large scales, we expect axions to behave exactly like cold dark matter. And also the scale at which the two terms on the right-hand side are equal, which is known as the axion gene scale, will vary as a function of mass. And so axions of different masses will affect different scales in the power spectrum. And so what this looks like in practice, this is generated using a modified Boltzmann code called axion cam. And what we see is a step feature in the power spectrum as we increase the axion fraction. So the axion mass in our two-parameter model is changing the scale at which we start to deviate from lambda CDM. And the axion fraction is essentially telling us the large scale, the small scale asymptote of our model. So even if I haven't really convinced you with the string axivers motivation at the beginning of the talk, this model is still very useful because as we are scanning for different MAs and different axion fractions, what we're looking for are discontinuities in the matter power spectrum. And these can be due to different models, including partial concentration of warm dark matter. So you can think of it as a very generic model testing for the continuity on different scales of the matter power spectrum. And so if we find a strong statistical preference for this type of model, that wouldn't prove the existence of axions outright, but it might indicate that there is something in the shape of the power spectrum. And a partial suppression might lead us to believe that the dark matter is composed of more than one ingredient with different different properties.
What's the gray band?
Oh, so the gray band here is the scales that we can probe using BOS. So this is foreshadowing actually what I'm about to show. But this is just to show that the axion masses that we can probe are dependent on our choice of observables and the scale that we can model. So if I take a 10 to the negative 24 EV axion, then the dip would be on the left hand, on the right hand side of this gray band. And for all of our scales that we can probe, it would be identical to cold dark matter. And so we wouldn't be able to see it even with BOS.
And the arrow, the small arrow, is the mass, the Brillouin wavelength, or what?
Is the scale at which the pressure term and the quantum pressure term are equal, the gravitational potential and the term are equal. And so as this gene scale has a root of m dependence. So as I move the mass to lighter and lighter, I'm going to move to the left. Thank you.
For comparison, how would neutrinos
look on this model? So neutrinos, the equivalence is around 10 to the negative 28 EV. That's the, in terms of if you match the gene scale to the free streaming scale of neutrinos, it would correspond to an axion about 10 to the negative 28.
For some choices.
Yeah. I mean that the axion gene scale would match the neutrino free streaming scale at that mass. So the yes.
Yeah.
But for a simple choice of neutrino mass.
Right.
The 60 to 100% of that.
Yeah.
So are they degenerate? Like
yeah. Yes, for that mass, yes. The difference between neutrinos and axions is that axions have a very steep very steep cutoff. While the neutrinos is a bit smoother, I think, but not by much. So yes, at those masses, they are degenerate. And at very low masses, at 10 to the negative 32 eV roughly, then the axions are degenerate with the total amplitude of the matter power spectrum, because we're not sensitive to this Ni feature. We're only sensitive to the final value. And so it feels like if you're only focusing on a gray band, as if we're simply measuring the total amplitude.
Is the redshift dependence also similar to the redshift dependence?
I don't know. I guess I'm not familiar enough with the growth of neutrinos.
I suppose that yes,
But yes, the degeneracy with neutrinos and other warm dark matter model at smaller scales is an open question in ultralight axions. So going from our linear theory power spectrum all the way to data, we're going to start by going with two to bus multipoles. And to do this, we're going to borrow a formalism called the EFT of large scale structures. So it's an effective field theory approach, which allows us to map our linear power spectrum, which with a set of bias terms, to the galaxy multipoles, which we can observe. So the galaxy power spectrum is not, like the linear power spectrum, isotropic. This is due to the fact that we are observing a bias tracer, we're observing galaxies, and the motion of galaxies along the line of sight distort their positions in space. And so there is a direction which is different than the others. And so the galaxy power spectrum is no longer isotropic. It depends on the direction of the wave vector rather than just its magnitude. But we can model it as a linear bias times the linear power spectrum on large scales, some higher order correction on smaller scales, some counter terms to stabilize some of the convolution integrals, which come in with the one loop correction, and also some stochastic terms, which account for things like shot noise. And the way to deal with this direction dependence, as is often done, is to split the wave vector between its magnitude and the angle between the wave vector and the line of sight, more specifically the cosine of that angle. And so mu is the cosine of the angle between the wave vector and our line of sight. And so for a wave vector moving straight along a line of sight, that would be one. And for perpendicular motion, that would be zero. And so we can then integrate over that angular dependence mu to get something which is dependent on just the wave number magnitude. But we can do even better than that. We can split this galaxy power spectrum into different multipoles using Legendre polynomials. The P of L zero is actually just integrating over it. It's equal to unity. And this is just a diagram showing the effect between real space and redshift space of the measurements of the positions of the galaxies. And you can see that along the line of sight, the positions are distorted with respect to their true real space positions.
But what is real space?
That's a very good question.
Possibly a reconstruction, maybe?
Possibly, yeah.
Less figured than, yeah.
So with this model in mind, we can then map our linear power spectrum, which we know and love very well, all the way to the galaxy multipoles, including the monopole. Unfortunately, we can see that the monopole exhibits the same kind of suppression as the linear matter power spectrum. And so we can hope to constrain this axion features or to see this axion feature in the galaxy power spectrum as well. Now, there's something interesting which happens with the quadrupole. And this is something that we saw initially in simulations. We saw that the quadrupole was actually enhanced rather than suppressed on small scales. And it wasn't clear at first what this enhancement was due to. In fact, I think it's Neil who pointed out that it could be a small scale bias that would cause exactly this effect. And so I went back to the theory model And I generated this figure keeping the bias terms constant and varying only the axion fraction to see if I would still see this enhancement on small scales. And it seems like it's still present. And so the way to understand why the quadrupole rather than monopole would be enhanced has to do with the angular dependence of mu. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this tangent, but this is just to say that if we take a simplified model that is not the full effective field theory, but rather just this redshift space distortion power spectrum with a Kaiser term up front and some Gaussian tail, we can see where the sigma v is the velocity dispersion of the tracers. And we can see that reducing sigma v, which is equivalent to dampening the power spectrum, will lead to a decrease in this term, will lead to an increase in this term. And the sensitivity to the decrease in this B of L term depends on the Legendre polynomials. And so different multipoles will be sensitive to different amounts to changing the velocity dispersion of halos. And what we see is that as we reduce sigma v, we see an enhancement that's very pronounced for the L equal 2 mode, but not so much for the L equals 0 mode. And so what this implies is that the quadrupole is more sensitive to this effect, to the effect of changing the velocity of dispersion of our tracers than it is than the monopole, which is something which is well understood. But what's surprising to us is that this is an enhancement rather than a suppression. And the enhancement is enough to overcome the suppression caused by the change in the linear matter power spectrum. And so this is just to illustrate a simple takeaway, which is that the velocity of the tracers is also very rich in information about the shape of the matter power spectrum, much more so than we initially thought. So what this plot is showing, going back to the full EFT picture, is the validation that we ran using not only the BOSS public catalogs, but also our own galaxy catalogs. We ran, and in one case, we even included axions to see if our model was able to detect axions if they are present. But most importantly, we don't detect them in the case where they're not present in cosmology. And so that was a sanity check that we wanted to make sure to have so that we don't.
Simulations for.
That's right.
And so that you're simulating the axion somehow, or are you just changing the linear matter power spectrum?
For these large scale simulations, we're only changing the initial matter power spectrum. We're dealing with 10 to the negative 27 or 28 EV axions. So in that case, the gene scale is really much in the linear regime. So that's a reasonable assumption. It wouldn't be the case for much heavier axions, though.
Yeah, I have a related question. So wouldn't you expect some effects from dynamics as well? Yeah, these light axions, they don't want to cluster as much as CDM, right? So wouldn't it suppress, say introduce some scale dependent bias or something like this at relatively short distances?
Yes, in fact, in 10 to the negative 28 EV, what we do is that we remove we change the value of omega matter in our calculation of the spherical collapse of halos that we use in our simulations to account for the fact that axions on those scales would have a de Broglie wavelength that is larger than even the largest halo in the box. And so they would not cluster at all. And so we assume that the halos are essentially all CDM in this case. This is something that we do in one intermediate step, but it's a detail that I forgot to mention. That's a very valid point.
Okay, thank you.
So after extensive validation, we proceeded to fit the BOSS data with the two redshift slices, the low Z and the higher redshift C mass sample. We did this for a range of masses, varying the axion fraction, keeping the mass fixed. In each of these cases, the bias parameters are varied differently for the two redshift slices, but the cosmological and axion parameters are kept constant across redshift. And in this case, we can reach constraint on the axion fraction at different mass, which is what you see over here. The gray band represents the clustering from the constraint from Planck, so from CMB. And the light pink and red represents our combined constraints, so with the CMB prior. And what we can see, looking at the allowed region, which is the colored region in this plot, is that for most cases, the axions are constrained at 1 sigma below 1% of the total dark matter content, and at 2 sigma below 5% for a lot of masses. This is not the case for 10 to the negative 25 EV for our observable, simply because the Ni feature of that mass is essentially at the very limit of our highest scale that we can probe, which is around 0.23 using this model. And so we have essentially one data point which allows us to constrain it. And with the bias terms, this gets a bit complicated.
So, are you fitting for all the EFD large constructor parameters at the same time?
Absolutely, yeah. And then we are marginalizing over the linear bias terms and the counter terms and so on.
And are there new terms you have to introduce if you have this massive neutrino? Sorry, the axions or is it the same terms?
So this is something that we had to check initially. And the short answer is that the value of certain of the counter terms, the amplitude would change, but their functional form wouldn't. And so if we're marginalizing over the amplitude of those terms, we're still getting the same EFT model. There's also the possibility of the one loop correction having some extra dependence on K because it's sensitive to even small scales. But what we find is that the axion power spectrum, if you look only at the axion component, is very damped on small scales where the de Broglie wavelength would show up. And so in that case, you do have some effects, but the density perturbations are so suppressed at those scales that they don't contribute to the one loop perturbation.
So this is also assuming that the only effect of axions is to change the initial linear matter power spectrum, right? It doesn't change the dynamics.
Right.
Is that right?
So that's what we wanted to test, actually. So we decomposed this into two contributions, right? There's the initial change to the matter power spectrum, and then there's the late time effects of the dynamics. And what we wanted to know is if the late time dynamics would change the one loop power spectrum, because the one loop power spectrum is sensitive to small scales. And this has to do with the fact that the gene scale goes as a to the negative 4. So it has a very strong redshift dependence. So the matter power spectrum dampening occurs as the gene scale at matter radiation equality. And for 10 to the negative 22 EV, that would be around 9 megaparsec inverse. While the late time effects would occur at around a scale of 60.
That's not 10 to the minus 4. Is 10 to the 3 at least, and then, so you mean that 1/4 or?
Sorry, a to the negative goes as inverse, sorry. K to the fourth goes as a to the negative 4. Yeah, good. Yeah. And so if we look at the change to the matter power spectrum, we will use this scale. And if we want to learn about the late time changes to the dynamics, we'll use this scale. And the idea is that the matter power spectrum is suppressed on scales below this one, to the point where any fluctuations at the gene scale today are very, very damped. And so if you calculate the one loop power spectrum and include the dynamical effects of the change of the growth function, it will only have a contribution at around 66 megaparsec, but the perturbations are essentially zero past 15 megaparsec inverse. There's an appendix dedicated to this calculation in our paper. I can go over a bit more in detail for those who are interested.
But then should I interpret this as saying that you're measuring the growth rate at the percent level at 1 sigma, like across range of scales?
We're measuring the dampening of the power spectrum at matter radiation quality, really just the shape of the matter power spectrum. Up to 1%.
Right, but as you said, though, I mean, the gene scale of all the redshift, right, you know, so at late times, gene scale is at much higher K, which means then that the growth rate F, you know, therefore depends on this axion mass. And so is that what you're, I mean, yeah. Like, so you're not marginalizing, you're saying over like the shape of the initial primordial power spectrum.
No, we are simply changing the we are only changing the shape of the monopole and quadrupole inferred from linear theory, from the linear theory matter power spectrum.
I guess it might be just useful just to understand like what parameters you're marginalizing over. Like if you marginalize that over, I guess like standard cosmological parameters, like things like NS.
Yeah.
You also marginalize, I guess, over like running of the primordial spectrum.
No, I think NS is fixed for a lot of studies with the EFT of LSS, which I think is also a choice that we've made.
You're not marginalizing over NS?
I'm marginalizing over AS, but not NS.
But the feature that you're using to contain the axion mass is the shape of the power spectrum?
Is the, yes, it's the presence of a step feature in the power spectrum.
Right, you're only probing some range of scales, and so then, but then it's not clear how to generate things like NS or running with your axion feature, right?
Yes, this is the case also with the amplitude of the power spectrum, yeah.
You could include a Planck prior, right? But you don't have a Planck CMB information here.
We are using a CMB prior for a lot of these constraints. For the strangest, the most stringent constraints, we are using a Planck prior.
Then it doesn't really matter, right? Computer.
Well, I mean, like the
font
doesn't constrain really well. Another
one, NS.
I would imagine that you'd want to marginalize over other things like the shape of the, you know, like the shape of the primordial power spectrum, but also, you know, mimic the, okay.
No, there are other parameters that we can include, definitely. This was we wanted to be as close as possible as the original EFT study, which fixed certain parameters, and so we fixed those as well. But it's really, we could try to vary then marginalize over them to see how these constraints would change. That's a very valid point.
Can you just, which parameters you're marginalizing over?
Certainly. So we're marginalizing over the linear biases, the amplitude of the one loop corrections, the 2-2 and 1-3 power spectra, as well as some counter terms and things like shot noise. So all of these are free parameters.
These are real strings, right? But there's also extra redshift parameters that are in redshift space.
Those are redshift space. These depend on the direction of the wave vector as well.
You have four bias parameters.
We have, I think, 7 in total. So some of them will have more than one contribution. And in fact, if you consider the two redshift slices, those go to 14 because the bias parameters are allowed to vary freely between redshift slices, plus the 6 cosmological parameters. It's quite a large number. And so speaking of the EFT of LSS, what we want to do soon is to include the bispectrum and the exadecouple, the L equals 4 moment. This is work done with in contribution to the creators of class BT at the IAS. And we are using this updated Boss likelihood, which includes these other observables. Now, the interesting part is that we've used the code called PyBird to calculate the counter terms and the EFT. And now we will be using class PT as a way to validate our results because the expansion is slightly different. The counter terms are slightly different between the two approaches. And so we would just want to make sure that our results are consistent across different expansions. We expect the bispectrum to improve our measurements of the axion fraction, but not at very low mass, because at very high mass, because we can only model the bispectrum to a scale of around 0.2. And so this concludes the first observable of the talk. The second one, in the interest of time, I will go over quickly. What we use is the cosmic shear power spectrum using DES observations of galaxy shear. This can be taught as a projection of the nonlinear matter power spectrum, which is integrated along the line of sight to see how much distortion we expect to see from structures between us and the source galaxies. Note here that because we are going to nonlinear scales, we need to include the nonlinear power spectrum, and this is going to be the challenge for using DES in our case. So the way to split the nonlinear power spectrum is to have two contributions, one which is the two halo term, which describes the correlation between particles between halos, and the one halo term, which is describing the distribution of matter within each halo. The advantage of this approach is that the two halo term is valid on large scales, while the one halo term dominates on small scales. And so we can well approximate the two halo term as just the linear matter power spectrum. But now all we've done is just push the difficulty to this one halo term. And the way to deal with this is to integrate over all halo masses, weighted with the halo mass function, which is the abundance of halos of a given mass, so the number density of halos that we expect to find at a certain mass, and this W term, which is the Fourier transform of the density profile. So that's saying, how do we expect the matter to be distributed within each halo of a given mass, and how many halos of that mass do we expect to see, and then we integrate over radius and mass. And that gives us our contribution to the one halo term. So what we need is, if we want to include axions, is the halo mass function and the halo radius density profile with axions. Now, thankfully, these simulations exist for the cases where axions compose all of the dark matter, that is F equal to one. And we can see that there is a suppression of small halos, as we've seen in the animations that we saw earlier. We also find a scaling relation for the shape of the soliton core that we find at the center of halos. And we can effectively model the shape of the soliton, the shape of the density profile given the particle mass and the halo mass and the redshift. So there are some very interesting scaling relations that we can implement into our one halo term to find a density profile. And again, there is some transition radius at around 3 times the core radius where the density profile is simply NFW. So using these simulations, calibrating our nonlinear power spectrum model, we can use the DES likelihood and derive constraints on the particle mass. And what we find is that at 95% confidence level, the dark matter mass has to be above 10 to the negative 23 EV. This is a rather weak bound compared to some other observables like the Lyman alpha forest. Yeah.
What did you do? You said simulations are 100% ULA. So how do you interpolate? We want to, not 100%. So what do you do?
So for that, you need to have simulations with a fraction,
yep,
which didn't exist until very recently. And I'm racing through this to get to the final part of the talk. So you're foreshadowing excellently what I'm about to show.
How do you do the next slide? Because next slide,
Exactly. This is assuming that it composes all of the dark matter. Absolutely. Yeah. We wouldn't be able to just extend it to different fractions. Yeah. So this is the challenge with DES and also the opportunity that we have because the dark energy survey is sensitive to scales of around 5 inverse H inverse megaparsec. And so in that case, we need to go through nonlinear theory, but we can go down to masses that weren't possible before. So just from Planck alone, we could go to around 10 to the negative 25.
Yeah, like so these cosmic shear correlation functions, is that what it is?
Yeah. And so we expect something like Euclid to be able to go down a few orders of magnitude, something like 10 to the negative 21 or 20 EV because of the improved angular resolution, assuming our modeling follows closely what we can measure, which is always the...
You don't have variance. Feedback.
No, not in this model.
What's going on with the turnover in the DES?
Yeah, that's a very interesting feature. It seems to have a very slight preference. I would have to go back to the paper to see why that is, but I think it's less than a sigma or something. It's possibly, yeah. So the idea is that if you include this axion fraction, you include if you include the ultra-wide axion, you allow the power spectrum to shape the changes a bit, and sometimes that's preferable on small scales rather than large scales. And so if you include Planck, which is larger scale, then yeah, then maybe this tension arises again, and you have better constraints.
But that was all again for with that. Okay.
Absolutely.
All this is then ruled out. Why do you then?
Because the methodology is interesting, and we hope to go even beyond that in the future. So that's a proof of concept. So yes, this bound is a lot weaker than some other bounds from Lyman Alpha Forest and Starostrians and dwarf galaxies. But we were able to include another observable in our toolkit.
But the existence of like small galaxies rules this by the nature, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But this is the proof of concept using DES to be able to probe these ultralight axions. It was a necessary first step.
Like a convoluted way of saying the same thing, right? Like your bound is just saying that the matter power spectrum gets suppressed, for these ultralight masses, but the way that you're suppressing the matter power spectrum on these small fields is by biting out the small payloads.
Yeah.
But the more direct way of saying that is that, well, the small galaxies that exist in small payloads. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. But the point here is that we hope to do this. We're currently working to do this with a fraction of dark matter. But the first thing we had to do is to at least validate that it works in the first case, which is that the 100% case.
Doesn't this allow you to connect to the sigma tension? Yeah, eventually. Isn't that the goal? Whether you can explain the sigma tension through some fraction of dark matter.
So highlighting the point that was made earlier, what we need is to be able to calibrate our halo model if we want to go beyond F equal to 1 with mixed dark matter simulations. And this is now possible thanks to a German group in Göttingen who have been developing this code called Axion Mix. And the way that it works is that it simulates cold dark matter using and well-known n-body techniques and evolves them according to the pressureless equation of motion. And then on top of that, as a Schrodinger Poisson solver, which evolves the ultralight dark matter in the fully nonlinear regime, and the two of them are coupled through gravity in the system that's known as a Schrodinger Poisson system. And what we see when we combine the two together is a simulation where both small clumps of dark matter can form, and also some wave interference patterns and some diffuse cores at the center of halos. So this is a side-by-side comparison of going through the two extreme cases, which are fully cold and fully fuzzy, and then the case in the middle. And we can see that we see some substructures, so some halos may be able to exist. They're not completely erased, which was one of the ways we constrained the fully fuzzy case. But we also see some interesting wave interference pattern, although not as pronounced as in the fully fuzzy dark matter case. So I hope to convince you that this dark matter model is, at least in my opinion, greater than the sum of its parts. It's something that's truly unique that exhibits new features that are not present in either of those alone. So from this, we can measure the nonlinear power spectrum and how it evolves over time. What we see in practice is that the nonlinear power spectrum is more suppressed on very small scales than the linear power spectrum. We expect these to match closely for very light masses, like 10 to the negative 26, for example, because the nonlinear effects are not that dominant on those scales, but the nonlinear effects really shape the matter power spectrum. For this is a mass of 10 to the negative 22 EV going to scale at over 100. And what we see is that the matter power spectrum is more suppressed in the presence of the full quantum effects, the nonlinear effects, than it is by just simulating n-body particles by changing the linear transfer function. This is true because the mass here is quite heavy. And so this occurs on very nonlinear scales. This also means that some of the small halos are more suppressed than initially thought when including this quantum diffusion. But these are very small halos and subhalos. We can also look at the density profiles and compare this to the soliton core solution that we saw earlier. The soliton core is in the dashed line here. This is the fully fuzzy fit to the density profile. And we can see that for high axion fraction, we recover that soliton shape because the cold dark matter doesn't dominate in the center of the halo. On the other hand, if we have a very large fraction of cold dark matter, say 90%, then the picture is a bit more complicated because the cold dark matter is allowed to cluster the center of the halo. It creates a very steep density gradient, which then pulls in the ultralight axions, which still want to form a core, but that core is squeezed. And so the radius of the core changes quite dramatically. Now, this heavily depends on the cosmic fraction of axions.
The previous work,
No, we are replicating the results that were found using spherical collapse. I think this is.
This is like a photo.
Yes. Yes, this is actually our co-author on this paper. And it was using, it was the first test of axion NICs, and it was using spherical collapse. And we are seeing the dark matter following the cold dark matter in the very, very center of the halo. But this is very the limit of what we can resolve. And so the region that I'm mentioning here is sort of the outskirt over here, which is not the very, very center of the halo, but slightly at around 1 kiloparsec.
Right, right. Comparing to your left panel, right? So there's no like, big enhancement on field of order due to rolling, but for your right hand panel.
That's right.
Which was their statement about that we don't see any of the solid body for the
given expansion. So we do see the shape of the density profile, at least slightly away from the density peak of CDM, that resembles what we would expect from the ground state solution of the Schrodinger Poisson system. And so that looks.
On their paper, they have said that there's no evidence or anything on multi-level budget, but they're really good.
Yeah.
Okay. And in your case, I guess it's the same statement. Except that maybe you have a 1 point at the smaller scale, maybe not, but there's no error levels of budget.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. So the two results are consistent. We don't have a 30% simulation, but we find that, yeah, that number from spherical collapse is probably good for simulations too. So yeah, we expect the soliton, if it does form, to at least be squeezed by the presence of cold dark matter. So that is just to say that the entire axion is distribution is squeezed by the strong density gradient.
Sorry, when you say squeeze, what do you mean?
I mean that if you were to look at the ground state solution of the Schrodinger Poisson system, you would find that the radius of half density is sooner than in the case where you only have. Because you're going to have a radius of half density, even if you don't have a proper soliton forming. And what I mean by squeeze is that the value of this half density radius is shorter than in the pure soliton case.
Of like a soliton, you know, the deal is just like the local de Broglie wavelength. Okay, so you're saying that the de Broglie wavelength is a little bit smaller here than it is. And 100%
axion case,
just because of the
velocity
is a little bit higher.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's just to say that, in short, the soliton fit that we used before, the scaling relation with Shive and al that was very useful, simply breaks down here. Because it depends, the shape of the density profile will depend on the cosmic fraction of axions, but also the local fraction of axions. So certain halos will have a different fraction than the cosmic fraction. This is especially true for very small halos. So the small halos that were erased in the fully fuzzy dark matter case now can still form out of the cold dark matter. But if these halos are smaller than the De Broglie wavelength of the ultralight particles, then they will not have that many ultralight particles as part of their halos. And so the total distribution of axions and cold dark matter will vary strongly between halo masses. So this ties into the small scale tensions that we saw earlier. For the core cusp problem, as we've seen, this depends very heavily on the involvement of baryonic feedback and star formation, but also on the fraction. So if the fraction is too low, we still see the formation of a cusp, and we don't have the same soliton profile that we that originally solved the core cusp problem. In terms of the missing satellites, we find that even a low fraction of axions can be very effective at wiping out a lot of the small scale structures. So it seems like the axion is not only good at cleaning the equations of QCD, it's also good at cleaning a lot of the small scale structure. And finally, when it comes to the rotation curve diversity, this is still something that we're studying in our simulation. This is preliminary work, but it seems like for different halos of different masses, because we have two dark matter candidates, their proportions might change from halo to halo and would explain why the rotation curves are not the same for halos of the same mass.
So I guess you're talking about simulations that have
full
baryonic feedback in them?
No, not at the moment. We've just started running simulations with the mixed dark matter case, but we hope in the near future to be able to include baryons on top of that.
People claim that these are all can be explained by a baryonic effect. So it seems that, you cannot have one or the other, one and a half. In fact, the last one, then the claim is that even baryonic effects cannot explain it. But I would imagine there would be some other simulation that could. I don't know what the status of that. But my point is that I guess you cannot really draw a conclusion from no baryon simulation.
Yeah, absolutely. The main source of these tensions that they were based initially on cold dark matter only simulations. But it's just.
I don't think the last one was based on baryonic simulation, but I don't think people were talking about that before.
That's possible. The solution that I've seen for the rotation curve diversity was self-interacting dark matter. That's one paper that I saw, I think. And
right, so this uses the diversity of baryon in galaxies to produce the diversity of rotation curve. The absence of baryonic scatter, it wouldn't be scatter and halo profile. But that's how this is. The interactions aren't dependent from halo to halo, right?
Exactly, but this is why I put that this isn't solved quite yet. But the idea is that having a mixed dark matter content interacting with baryons would then cause quite a wide range of expected rotation curves.
I guess it's just not clear that this is a problem, right? If we see diversity in galaxies, so then, given that huge diversity in galaxies, that is and similarly, missing satellites, and 100 years ago, that's not going to be a problem. Today, actually, strong constraints can be placed on even one dark matter just from the observed abundance of the small satellite galaxies. And so, instead of calling it a missing satellite problem, instead you have to explain, the number of small galaxies that you see in the dark matter model.
Absolutely, that's something that we're hoping to do. In fact. So we have a sub-halo finder that we're running on a Milky Way size halo for about 10% of 10 to the negative 25 eV axions. And we're comparing the exact same simulation with cold dark matter. And we're trying to see the abundance of satellites of sub-halos in those two cases.
Right, yeah. I guess my point is that, so instead of calling this a missing satellites problem, instead, now let's say constraint on deviations from TDM, then you have to at least match as many satellites that TDM does.
Yes, I would agree with that. These are not as stringent tensions as something like the Hubble or SAT, nowhere near that. But they were the initial motivations for fuzzy dark matter. And yeah, so I wanted to tie back into. Yeah.
But now, thanks to the satellite from the, you know, the constraint is actually the other way.
Yeah. I guess I just wanted to finish the loop and go back to the initial, even though these problems are not as dire as they were, you're essentially solved a lot by baryonic physics. I wanted to tie it back to the initial ones. I don't know if that satisfies your comment.
I'm not sure if you're getting my point.
Yes, but no, these are no longer problems, but these were my initial motivations to look at these. So that's why I'm mentioning them in passage, but these are not the main focus of our study as much as implementing nonlinear studies, nonlinear physics into a model to use DES. To reach stronger constraints. So just to summarize, as I'm on the hour, we've seen that we can produce axions in string theory, but we do it in a plenitude with many different axions of different masses. We saw that this interesting model led us to having a subdominant ultralight component, which then ties into a lot of extensions of lambda CDM, which have been proposed to solve cosmological tensions. We've seen how we can use improved modeling on semilinear and nonlinear scales to hope to constrain axions to heavier and heavier masses and lower fractions using galaxy and lensing surveys. Finally, we saw the development of these new simulation tools, which I've just started running and look very, very promising. So I hope I've convinced you that this mixed dark matter model is a lot richer than the sum of its parts. Thank you.
Questions. If you're online, feel free to unmute and ask questions because I can't see you.
No. I was interested in the discussion at the end. I don't know, this might be a question for either the speaker or for Neil, I'm not sure. So apart from the motivation of axions in terms of solving the strong CP problem, in terms of the other cosmological motivations from them, would you say, in other words, at 1.6 or so years ago, there was a lot of excitement about them being possibly a solution of various tensions to do with galaxy formation, et cetera. What's the current status of that? Would you say that they're allowed, or is it that they are actually motivated by resolving some current tensions?
Sure. So that really depends on the mass and the scale that we're probing. A lot of the ultralight axion model were ruled out by the fact that we see the small galaxies forming, and in fact that even sometimes they do form in our models, but the density is just too high at the center. The soliton core is too massive for what we see in the small galaxies. How these questions arise when we allow for the fraction to vary. This is what I hope to do. And so a lot of the initial constraints from around 6 years ago applied to the fully fuzzy dark matter case. And so we're expanding the parameter space.
Well, I guess Akamai division is to keep as much as deployed. So
I meant apart from that. But I just as asking, so is it, have the observational motivations for it, as opposed to setting aside the question of whether it could exist, because of course if there's, you know, add enough free parameters, it can exist. But have the observational motivations for it that were exciting people 6 years ago or so gone away, or are there any of those that remain? Tensions that supposedly were resolved could be resolved by something like that.
Right. Okay. Well, right. Yeah. So the original small scale problem were these things like the core dust, missing satellite. Okay. Now we know that missing satellite, but
That one's gone away.
You have to simulate the variance problem.
So it's not really what it is.
So now the number of smoothing rate satellites that we see is so large, but also still matching TDM prediction that you can't actually tolerate a suppression.
Okay. It's just the right
down
number. Just the right number of satellites.
down to the masses that are probed by for us, arguably that's still a concern.
How strong would you say that one is?
So the issue, is that some small galaxies do have cusps and some have cores. And so, purely dark matter
it has to do with the De Broglie wavelength, it seems.
But in a purely dark matter only solution, that accounting for very high physics, it's hard to imagine how, putting in a dark matter solving solution, for example, the fixed ability equation, to solve that if you don't account for the diversity of galaxies that form.
So these are ways to constrain the dark matter model rather than the,
So you talk about Axiverse and how you're testing it, but I guess really you're just testing fractional axon dark matter, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any plans to look at this log 10 distributed mass? And I guess my question is, if that was the case, would you even see something? Like if you had something at 10 to minus 23 eV, for example, and then you start adding lighter axions, does that change anything in your picture? Or?
I think there's one paper that looked at the density profiles of using a simplified model with different axion species, and they had essentially cores of different sizes that were interacting with each other. That would be very interesting to look at as you add more ultralight particles. Then in that case, if you assume that they're independent, that they're uncoupled, then the matter power spectrum will have multiple of these steps. And so looking for one step is essentially ruling out other, if you have more of these axions on top of the one step that you observe. What's interesting to me is that it's been shown that the axions can couple to each other if you have a very specific Lagrangian. And so in that case, you could have something like a dark energy field and a dark matter field interacting with each other, because these axions below 10 to negative 33 eV have as dark energy. And so adding these dark energy axions might actually have some couplings. But this gets a wide range of free parameters. But yes, adding multiple axion species might give you a completely different cosmology.
By coupling, do you mean something the size of gravitational interaction?
Exactly. So coupling in the potential shape.
Can we take one more quick question if there's anyone? No, let's thank Alex again.